The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Bane Free Radio Hour. I'm your host, Jeremy Como. Enough about that. Let me introduce you to the men that you probably clicked on this video to see. The first gentleman needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. Mr. David Weber, New York Times bestselling author and creator of the Honor Harrington series, and along with him, his co-author, Richard Fox, bestselling author and winner of the 2017 Dragon Award for Best Military Science Fiction and Fantasy Novel. He's best known for the Ember War Saga, military science fiction and space opera. So welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for coming on. Before we get started, we'll go with Richard first. Richard, go ahead and promote anything that you want to promote, and then we'll go on to David.
Sure thing. We have an amazing novel called Rebel, which is part two of the Ascent to Empire series, which is very nine. You can pre-order it right now at Amazon and all fine book retailers everywhere, which is the second story in Terrence Murphy's story rise to empire or to emperor. And this is a very important, very action-packed, thrilling chapter of that rise to power. And it was just an absolute honor to work with David on it. And then other things coming up. I just finished completing the Weapon series, which is a military sci-fi series that is follows a soldier who was denied death on the battlefield and forced to fight on as a cyborg, essentially enslaved to his commanders, and then breaks loose and all sorts of trouble happens afterwards. So if you pick up the Weapon series, is out on Amazon and Audible right now.
Thank you. David, what you got going on, sir?
Well, gee whiz. I mean, Richard just sort of gave away my thunder here on Rebel. Darn, you know. The Rebel is the one that is currently out. Mm-hmm. I think the most recent one out before that was probably Toll of Honor, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Jane Linscold and I have handed in the fifth of the Star Kingdom books, and Tony Weisskopf has done her read through on it, and we are anticipating getting the manuscript back from her sometime very soon. In some ways, it's a darker book than the ones that have come before, because we deal with some stuff that is darker. Specifically, we deal with abuse of childhoods and surviving them. And I got a whole bunch of other stuff kind of cooking away that I am behind on. you would know about some of those. Yes. But there's a lot of stuff being organized right this minute in the Honorverse and in Norfressa and whatnot for projects going forward that I am really excited about. Jacob Hullo's Edward Saganami series. Mm-hmm. Jan Kudyk with the Silesian Command, and Mark Sarnow in Silesia, and of course Marisa and I will be starting probably sometime pretty soon on the first of our novels, continuing the Crown of Slaves storyline from the Honorverse. We need Jacob and Tom to complete a novella they're working on first, because it's going to set a lot of the foundation that we will be launching the novel from. But there's a lot of stuff in the stacks being worked on, and hopefully you guys will be seeing some of it like sometime pretty soon.
Oh, I'm excited. Yeah, you are a busy man, because just from the interviews that I've done with you, we've done a lot of interviews lately for your books that are releasing. You've got a lot of books that are already out, and then of course the projects you were just speaking of. You've kind of become the godfather to a lot of authors come up. You've been collaborating so much and will continue. So it's I think that's very, very cool that you know you're working with all these
different authors. Well, I'm trying to do that for several reasons. One is sort of mentoring in a way. Mm-hmm. Another is trying to help open doors for writers that I think deserve space on the shelf or in your memory card, and maybe get some of those doors opened a little sooner. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, another part of it is that at 72, which I'll be in October, my productivity rate is not what it was when I could work four hours nights, mm-hmm. you know, indefinitely before I fell on the floor. So it's one of the things that I am looking to here is I have literary universes that grew beyond, in many respects, what I expected them to grow to, which is definitely not a complaint, but it means that they evolved places for stories other than those I had originally envisioned setting in them. They grew beyond those stories, if you will. And one of the things that I'm working on is trying to find and to bring into those universes younger writers who can help to carry those universes on and continue to explore them when I am no longer writing in them. And that's a fair amount of where a lot of the current collaborations are. Not that I'm planning on stopping next week. Well, okay. But the problem is that handing off a literary universe is always chancy. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a lot chancier if the person you're handing it to has not already gotten into the DNA of the series, hasn't already become a contributor and a builder in that series, and had a chance to adapt to the storytelling style that the readers in those universes are looking for. And the best way to acquire that feel for the universes is to work with the person who effectively created them in the first place. And I wouldn't be looking at anyone to hand them over to who I didn't think had quite a lot to contribute to them going forward. So we might as well start getting some of those contributions slotted in at an early stage, while I can help to sort of introduce that new directions, new content, new concepts to the established readers. So that's a big part of what's going on that front.
Yeah, and I think it's great, because you know, some authors who may not be named will let a series die, you know, and not complete the series or you know, do it because it's their baby and they want to hold it. We all know who I'm talking about.
Yeah. I
think it's great that you're not, you know, you're thinking of the fans and you're thinking of these authors. So kudos to you.
I think the part of the problem is that if a universe grows sufficiently, then even after you've finished the story arc, the primary story arc you had in mind, mm-hmm. the reader has this sense that you haven't finished the series, because the universe is still there and it's continuing. It's still mm-hmm. growing. Mm-hmm. You didn't just say, well, the universe stopped because my character completed her or his story arc. And that's kind of what's happened, for example, in the Honorverse. Because Honor Harrington's story arc, the one that I had envisioned for her, really wrapped up in Uncompromising Honor. As a matter of fact, she was supposed to die in At All Costs. No, I'm sorry, in a rising thunder. I flipped her and McKeon's role because of timing things that happened when Eric and I were working on Crown of Slaves. But she's also then appeared in To End in Fire, which is another novel in the Crown of Slaves storyline. Okay. I don't see the Honorverse as a series. I see it as an ongoing living literary universe that is going to continue to grow and change and is going to continue to throw up new characters and new challenges as we go along. And that's what I want to sustain. The one series that I am pretty sure that I personally won't have time to finish, but that I want to make damn sure gets wrapped up the way that I had envisioned, is the Norfressa series I'm handing off to Marisa. And she and I have talked about it, and I trust her to get to the point that I meant to get to. And I intend to go on writing in that universe, and I hope, you know, I may very well be wrong about how long it's going to, you know, whether or not I'm personally going to get to write the entire series. There are four more books to come, though. And like I say, I'm 72 this year, and I have other projects that I need to do. The one that I absolutely need to wrap up myself is not a Bane series. It's the Safehold series with Tor. And that I should be able to do in another couple of books. So I'm confident about finishing that one. But yeah, I think to my mind, it's okay. The reader doesn't have a right to demand that his or her writer finish the series. But the writer has a responsibility to finish the storyline out if he or she can. Okay. Now, you have to write what is working for you at the time that you're writing, too. And if what is working for you is not Series A, then go and write in Series B, because by doing so, you will be producing your better stuff, because it's the stuff you need to be writing at that point, if you follow me.
Yeah.
But that's wandering into philosophical weeds. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of collaborations, Richard, this is the second book in this series. Rebel was the second book in this series. Have y'all written together before this series?
Nope. No, this Scent Empire was the first time.
Okay. So I'm gonna ask Richard first, and then David, you can edit, rebuke, whatever, the story, tell your side of the story. So how did this come to be? How did you guys meet and decide you wanted to write together and write this particular series?
Sure. We met, I think it was 2018 or 2019 at a conference called the Archers Rest Society. And I was one of the people who helped organize it. We had a lot of really great, amazing authors who came to talk and discuss more about what it's like to be being an author. And of course, David was one of the guests of honor. Kevin J. Anderson, he was also there. And so while we were there, I got to talking with David. And you know, and I had been reading David's book since I was a plebe at West Point. Mm-hmm. And one of my history professors said, "You need to." I told her, there's not a lot of really good leadership examples in fiction. She says, "Oh, no, you need to read on Basilisk Station." So I read that, and it was all downhill from there.
wait. Downhill from there.
No. It was like, "Oh, I'm going to read all of these now."
Okay. Boy, fortuitous. You know, there every so often I tweak Richard's prose just a little bit.
But so then while I was there, I asked, I was going to ask David for, if he could, you know, just be so kind as to be a mentor. And he went up me and said, "How would you like to write a series with me?" And he threw a couple ideas at me. And I said, the prequel to, and Fury Born, like, yeah, that will work just if I can do that one pretty easy. So, and then we talked it out, and then we came up. Well, David, he's had this story in his head since the 90s, mm-hmm. and I think he's so glad he can finally get it out of his head. Yeah, and true. so we put together the outline, and then we've been lately for the last few years, when they have the 20 books to 50K conference in Las Vegas, we'll get together and hash out outline the next book. So.
Yeah. Now we're not doing the successor to 20K this year. Sharon and I aren't. But we will still hash. Okay. I mean, that will happen. We may wind up doing it through Zoom rather than sitting in the restaurant with people looking at us very strangely while we talk about blowing up planets and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing.
I imagine they'll get a little animated talking about that kind of stuff.
Oh well, it's not as bad as with some people that I've worked with who like wave their hands when the explosions happen. You know, Richard and I are much more restrained than that. We just go, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's a pretty fair description of the process. And I have had this story kicking around. This story was firmly in my brain when I wrote the original Path of the Fury, which came out in what, 90,
96?
It was that late?
Mid-90s, I think.
Okay. I can't remember, but it was one of the first novels that I actually sold to Bain. Jim had bought like five of my novels before the first, well, including my collaborations with Steve White, the first, which was the first book, Bain book that he bought. But he bought about five of my titles before the first one saw print, which was, I thought, very either courageous or foolhardy of him with somebody who had no track record, but worked out fairly well, I guess, you know, for all concerned. It did right. Well, it gave me an opportunity to go full-time writing, mm-hmm. A lot sooner than most people are able to do it. Because now, and he was getting first novel prices for all of them, which was advantageous for him, mm-hmm. well as that cash flow was advantageous for me. And he also happened to be possibly the best editor/publisher I have ever met. Possible exception of Tom Doherty. I mean, just it. I could not have fallen into a better web of evil than Bain Books. Okay. But yeah, this is Rebel is actually in many ways the pivotal point in Terrence Murphy's life. Reading Governor, you might have thought that was, but this is really the point at which things come into a different focus for him. And it wound up actually being a little, I won't say darker, a little uglier.
It gets heavy.
Yeah, than I had originally planned on, mm-hmm. and don't know how to put it exactly. Murphy is, in some ways, the most driven of my protagonists. Okay. I mean, you know, you look at Colin McIntyre in the Dahak books, he has an even harder road to hoe than Terrence does. But Terrence Murphy is Terrence Murphy is an optimist trapped in a dystopia. Okay. Mm-hmm. And a responsibility taker who sees it as his responsibility to fix the dystopia. And who thought he could fix it and discovers that he has to break it instead. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so structuring him and building the, I never want any of my characters to become Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Last Action Hero and get loose in the real world, because there won't be a hole deep enough for me to hide in after what I've done to them, you know, kind of thing. And Murphy is, he might not be at the very head of the pack pursuing me down that alley, but he'd be somewhere in the forefront. And this book, I think, I like this book a lot. Despite the fact that, as I say, it has some really dark stuff happening in it. I think sometimes there has to be enough dark to make the light show.
That's how you build some really cool characters. Lots of trauma.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, and then you sit and you say to yourself, oh, geez, what kind of a person am I that I can do this to this poor character in this book who has no defense against anything, you know, kind of thing. And then you say to yourself, come on, David, it's just a character in a book. But then you say to yourself, no, it's not. Okay. And I'll say this too. If the character, I've said this before, if the character doesn't matter to the author, the storyteller can't make the character matter to his audience. Okay. And if the character matters to you, then you look at what you've done to him and you go, oh geez. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's a hard, it's a point that sometimes is a little hard to get across to someone, the relationship that you as the writer have with your characters.
Now this series, the Ascent to Empire series, is and pardon my ignorance, but is it a standalone series or is it off from a previous?
It is a prequel series, mm-hmm, to the novel, excuse me, In Fury Born. Mm-hmm. In Fury Born is actually, excuse me, the novel Path of the Fury and its immediate prequel novel bound into a single set of covers. So in a sense, this is, in some ways, this is the fourth novel in the honor in the Furyverse, if you will, universe, kind of thing. But these books are set several hundred years earlier than In Fury Born. Alicia DeVry, excuse me, the heroine of In Fury Born, is a member of the Imperial Cadre, which are the personal household troops of the Terran Empire, ruled by the House of Murphy. These books are how the House of Murphy came to be the empire that the royal house of the empire that does not exist when these books begin, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So this is in a way, it's going back and giving you the foundation for the later novels that were actually written almost 30 years earlier. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm glad it makes sense to you. I'm not sure it makes sense to me, but yeah, you know, it's just, I live in a world where things frequently don't make sense. I just you know.
Now, with these, not because they're prequel, can you read them standalone, or should you go back and read the previous series?
Oh, Richard, I would say that you definitely, if you have the option, you should read these books first, wouldn't you?
Yes, yeah. and it's
and then read In Fury Born.
Right. But it's but there's a lot of things. I mean, like, nothing in this series is going to spoil the In Fury Born books.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to, if you read both Governor Rebel and you pick up In Fury Born, you're like, oh, okay, that's the Emperor, and now we have his descendants.
Yeah.
So you could read, and in fact, I encourage everyone to read all of these books as soon as possible.
Of course.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
buy them for your friends.
Yeah. Well, okay. The thing is that you can read them. You can read them in complete isolation, read the two, if you will, series in complete isolation from one another. Okay. Either one of them should read just fine as a standalone, pick it up and go with it. Mm-hmm. If you have read In Fury Born first, okay, then you're reading these books, you're going, oh, that's how that happened as part of the backstory of world building for In Fury Born. You're like, oh, that's how the House of Murphy did thus and so. That's why this particular planet is so especially loyal to the House of Murphy in the time of Alicia DeVree in the In Fury Born novels. Okay, so if you've read them first, then you're discovering the seed corn that's been planted in this series and recognizing it for what it is. If you've read these books first, then when you get to Path to the Fury, you go like, oh, so that's how that worked out 300 years further down the road. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you can read them in whichever order you like. I would recommend reading first Governor and then Rebel rather than Rebel first and then Governor. But as far as the series is concerned, you can read them in whatever order you like.
So speaking of, so this series, we're in two books in. What are the plan, if you can say, what are the plans for future books in this particular series?
Well, it's a Bane trilogy, so you know it's okay. We are looking at a minimum of two more books, a minimum, and probably more than that. It's a big canvas, and in many ways, travel in this universe is slower than in the Honorverse. It takes longer for messages to get where they're going and fleet movements and that kind of thing. So the real ugliness mess that is coming down the pike is only just starting to move as of the end of this book. And in fact, quite a bit of it is totally off stage at this moment. The reader won't know that it's in motion until we're into the next book, if you see what I'm saying, because the characters, the protagonists that we've introduced you to don't know yet about the other bad stuff that's coming down. To be honest, Rebel is in a very, very short time frame of in-universe time for this universe. Very short. A lot of ships that were in motion and so forth come into collision early on in it. That part of the storyline gets resolved. And then Murphy discovers that he has to go dashing off in a totally different direction. We packed a lot into a relatively short spread of days in this book. Particularly in light of how long it takes to get from point A to point B.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about collaborations earlier. So every partnership is different, and you know, division of labor and all that. So how did y'all go about doing that for this series? You know, who did what? Was there was there somebody doing more of a focus on one particular aspect of the book, or is it just kind of a mix of everything?
Well, first,
I would never try to out space battle David Weber. So
I would say, okay, the spinal cord of the series is mine because it's the backstory of a novel that I did 30 plus years ago and which I had built in my brain at the time. The primary, as in historical characters in the series are mine, Murphy and you know, his wife and whatnot. The secondary characters, and they're secondary only in the sense that they aren't already baked into the mix. I'm not saying they're unimportant characters, that they don't carry a hell of a lot of weight in the storyline or anything like that. I'm just saying that these are the ones that come into existence as you're working on the storyline, rather than having been baked in from the very beginning. Okay, those are a lot more of co-creation, and in fact, two of the characters who I like best from Governor are the character development, the what they go through and how they handle it and so forth is almost all Richard. I'm talking about Ira and Callum in the first book. We knew what was going to happen with those two characters, but how we got there, okay, was Richard in the rough draft. And then I polished and moved and did stuff around. Basically, we sit down, we talk about, okay, what are we going to do in this book? Oh, that'll be ugly. The readers will love it. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We have to have a pretty darn detailed timeline simply because of the movement of information in fleets and so forth. Figuring out how long it takes to get from point A to point B determines how the plot has to lay out, because you've got to cover those time points, if you follow me. There's usually a lot of looking at that kind of thing in there. And I'm the one who normally has to figure out how long it takes for this event to be able to happen, the soonest it can happen. And then we work within those constraints, filling the storyline out. And then Richard takes our notes and he puts together okay, this is where we're going with this, you know, kind of what you might think of as the bullet point version of it. And I look at it and I say, and I say, ooh, no, that won't work. You know, so it seemed like a good idea when I first had it, but now I see it won't work, you know, kind of thing, that sort of thing. Push it around, nail down the dates, hand it back to Richard. Richard does the rough draft, leaving some areas for me to do, like the space battles and whatnot. And then he sends it to me, and then I tear the entire damn thing apart, drive him crazy, moving it around. And for example, the whole Bellerophon plot line got developed after, I think, Richard was pretty well launched into the draft, I think, at the point that we said, oh, wait, no, this is going to have to move here. That's going to have to go there. And then I do the final, I send it back to him and get his input and any place where he thinks we need to tweak this, do that. Then I do the final edit and we send it off to Tony and hope that she won't tear it into too many pieces, kind of thing. It's the process is not quite as orderly as it might sound from what I just said. But Richard does an awful lot of the early heavy lifting in getting this laid out and building scenes and whatnot. And then I come along and I polish scenes and I do the occasional additional bridge that wasn't in there to get from point A to point B, that sort of thing. I think it makes for a partnership where there's a lot of input from both sides in the final product. These books are definitely not the ones that I would have written solo. And I mean that in a good way. They're not the ones that Richard would have written solo, because I jump all over and say, no, we can't do that. And he goes, okay, you know, kind of thing. Be that way, you know. Let's put it this way. If I were Richard, every so often I'd be going, I'd be that way, you know, kind of thing. But it's that synergy, I think, that makes them work as well as I think they're working. I think these are strong books. I think that they move quickly despite the stretched out time frame of the movement and internal events in the books. I think people are going to care about the characters. And I have to say that Rebel has one of the most villainous villains, excuse me, that has ever appeared in any of my books. It's kind of like Oscar Saint-Just from the Honorverse wanted to get hands-on in the wet work. Mm. Okay. I mean, he's that kind of sicko, you know. For Saint-Just, it was never personal, okay? It was just he had zero sense of empathy for anybody that was not part of his problem solution. Okay, this particular villain has plenty of empathy, as long as whatever the people around him are feeling is bad. Okay. I mean, that's basically he's, I would call him the scum of the earth, but I've known some scum that was, you know, not, I've known a lot of scum that wasn't as scummy as this guy is scummy. And I do. I will say that I adjusted the timing on it. And I fiddled around with some of the details. But what ultimately happens to our villain, Richard and I had both agreed that it had to happen to him, you understand. But the way that it happens, okay, Richard put that together. And I said, well, that works pretty well, actually. I especially like the, oh, you misconstrued a hypothetical solution here kind of thing, which is very unhappy for the villain. Yes, I thought that worked very well. And Richard had one line that he absolutely had to be in the book.
It's a one word line.
And I will just tell you, you won't understand until you get there why it's a really good line, but the one word line is tungsten. Okay, I mean, it's just like, it's kind of Shannon Fork or Oops level of people will remember this one, I think. I think Richard done good.
It's for that character. In a prior life, I was a military intelligence officer in the United States Army, and I did two tours in Iraq. And so the Alimo character, he ends up being a lot of not what the army was doing, but what Saddam used to do.
Yeah.
To all the people. So like all the Iraqis would tell me about the things that Saddam used to do. And they were pretty horrific. And David, you know, he had to get me to, he got me off the wall at one point where I said, let's have this one scene in a stadium with mass punishment. And David's like, back up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and I was like, okay, fine. Can we do this scene with this other interrogation method? He's like, oh yeah, that works. And it's just
yeah. Richard pushed me further than I would have gone in the direction of that sort of thing. And in this instance, for this book, that's a good thing. Okay. But by the same token, you reach a point where it's kind of like writing combat. Okay. Nobody can possibly write combat as bad as it actually is. You just can't do it. Even if you've been there and lived through it, trying to communicate how bad it really is in the written word to somebody who hasn't been there himself or herself. Okay. It just can't be done. Okay. So there are a lot of wrong ways to write combat. Okay. One is to try to sanitize it, to pretend it's not horrible. or that to do like a really bad World War II movie where only the bad guys die or the good guys die instantly if they take a hit, you know, kind of thing, in which collateral damage is, you know, that's not something that happens. You know, we're not going to burn down the village and accidentally kill everybody in it because of the strong point the enemy has in the village that we have to clear. That's, you know, not going to happen. It is going to happen in real life. So you can sanitize it. You can try and make it so vanilla that it becomes splatter porn. Okay. It becomes a form of pornography in my mind. Okay. The other, another wrong way to do it is to say, well, I can't write it as bad as it is, so I'm going to write it as bad as I possibly can. I'm going to come as close to it. I'm just going to grind the reader into it. The problem there is that you burn the reader out. You destroy the reader's sensitivity to what's happening, which probably would happen to somebody in the actual combat situation. But you are then taking away from the reader the experience that you're trying to share with them in telling the story in a lot of ways. And you can do it the way that I try to do it, which is to let you see the psychological costs, the emotional cost to the characters, and every so often to hit you squarely between the eyes with something that is just horrific, but not to give you every blood spatter in the writing. Well, the same thing is true when you're dealing with villains and how you're going to portray their villainy. Okay. And to portray a villain realistically, in a lot of ways, you have to be able to get inside the villain and make the villain understandable to the reader. All right? That's where you really meet nightmare, is when you get inside a character and you say, yes, I can understand how he would feel that way. You go, oh, shit, I just said I understood how Oscar Saint-Just could be who he is. Okay? That's a scary moment. Okay? With this character, Alima, you don't want to get inside his head, okay? I mean, the writer doesn't want to get inside his head. We have to understand why he's doing what he's doing, okay? But in this particular character, there is zero desire on my part or on Richard's part to have any empathy for him at all. Okay, he is as bad a person as we can conceive of being. Now, there are reasons, the main one being that he's crazy as a bedbug, but that you know, when you see him in action, he's totally internally consistent because we understand what's driving him. But neither one of us likes him a bit. Neither one of us has any sympathy for him. And both of us went, yay, rah, when tungsten got pronounced. I mean, you know, it was just, this guy's bad. But his very badness is what underscores the fundamental corruption of the entire system that Murphy is facing, because the people who sent him out knew exactly what they were doing.
So, with that, and I'm here to tell the reader, future readers, if you haven't already read it, I concur with your assessment. This guy is sadistic, and you hope for his demise.
Oh yeah. I the only people who met him who don't want to be around when he dies are the people who are almost as sick as he is, you know. Mm-hmm. Pavel Jung is probably the only other one of my characters who comes close to having as few people who will ever want to, who will ever miss him as this guy. Okay. I mean, you know, and most people are like, thank God Pavel's gone. So that should tell you what, you know, what they're going to be saying about this character. But he's a very clarifying character. As a matter of fact, the entire Terran Empire down the road should be very grateful to him. Because in the final sense, he's what clarifies Murphy. or he's the Richard, would it be fair to say that he's the proximate cause of what clarifies Murphy? Because what actually clarifies him is the, I know now why he was sent.
Yeah, it's the decision to somebody in the government broke glass in case of war, and unleashed this guy, mm-hmm. and I don't want to give away too many of the details, but the fact that the powers that be said this is the solution, yeah. It kind of underscores that, like, oh, if that's the solution to this, we understand what your solution is to everything else.
Yes,
and when you do that kind of a thing, it's like, all right, you completely understand the character of the individuals you're working with, and yep. you see that, like, it's not something that can be fixed. It's something that has to be burnt down and rebuilt. I mean, the cancer was in the bones.
If you think this is an acceptable option, then you are not an acceptable presence in the universe, is kind of the way that you have to look at it. And it also clarifies not just the option that you've selected to deploy, the weapon you've chosen to deploy here in the form of a LIMO. It's not just that. It's also that the system in which you're operating allowed you to do it. Okay. That's a huge part of the problem. If you could be in a position to do this and not be held to account by the system, then the system fundamentally needs to be broken. Okay? Because of the way it's been perverted and twisted. And that comes hard for Terrence Murphy. It's not what he ever wanted to do. That Murphy is he's one of, to me, one of in my books, he's one of the more interesting characters, because he signed up to assume his responsibilities to fix what was wrong with the system, and finds his responsibilities pushing him to the recognition that fixing the system isn't really possible. That it has to be, the fixing involved in this case is going to be jacking up the body of the car and running an entire new chassis in under it, if you see what I'm saying. And he's paying a price for it, in his personal life, and in what it's doing to his family. Now, I also, for those of you who have read In Fury Born or Path of the Fury and met the cadre, okay, you may not know it if you are reading these books, but you have also already met the first member of the cadre. Although her relationship with the cadre is going to be just a little bit more convoluted than that. But what can I say? I think, there have been characters in this book, which is, I think, the mark of a story that's going places. There have been characters in this book that have moved to places, in these two books, that have moved to places that we did not envision when we first started writing them. They have evolved in the course of the story into different people fulfilling different functions in the story from our original grand scheme of things when we were laying out the character set. Simran, Murphy's wife, is going some places that had not been on our original plan for her, because the internal dynamics are working out differently in the Federation. from where we had originally planned on. But I think that's good, because that's the mark of a story that is growing for the storyteller as well as for the audience.
Well, and I will attest to the character development in Rebel was really good, because you, at least when I read it, with his family and what happens with them, and this, you know, the consequences of his actions and all that, I really had buy-in to these characters, and I cared what happened to them. And to me, that's always you know, a good sign of character development and storytelling, because you can't, I mean, you're staying till the end, because you got to know what happens with these characters. So, you know, good job, of course.
Stories are always about the characters if they're going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not just about the giant stompy robots. It's not about the starships. It's, you know, that's the canvas on which the characters live, die, and love and hate and interact with one another. That doesn't mean that the other elements of the story are unimportant, but it means that unless those characters are there at the living, breathing heart of the story, it's not going anywhere, not in the long run. And I think that that's one of the things that we have accomplished here. I hope so. Anyway, sounds like from what you're saying that we're at least in the ballpark. Good sign, Richard. Okay,
you're doing all right.
Okay. good.
So speaking of characters, let's start with you, Richard. Did you have a favorite character to write, whether it's because you the person, because they were so good or so bad, or it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be one or the other, but did you have a character that you really enjoyed writing?
Yeah, there's the character Captain Yildiz in Rebel. Mm-hmm. And he kind of comes in towards the end, but I liked writing him because he's a good person in a bad situation. And he does what he can to deal with it.
Yeah.
And so I really like that character. And then, you know, as far as with Alimo, he was just fun, because it's like, you know, it's write a character who's more than likely a sociopath. And
okay. Richard, yes, if he was fun for you to write.
Well, it was easier if you just
I just want counseling might be somewhere in your future. I mean,
well, this is the counseling, right? He writes it on the paper.
But it's with Alimo, it's like, oh, I can, you know, a lot of the restrictions that you would, a normal person would have, just get taken away. Like, oh, okay, let's have fun with this. And it was almost, you know, when, like, if you remember the original Batman scene or the original Batman movie where the Joker comes into the art house and they start playing Prince. And, you know, when I got to start writing Alimo scenes, it felt kind of like that. It was, I mean, I wasn't listening to Prince, but it's like, it was that kind of, oh, here's this, you know, let's go crazy a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
and enjoy that. And then for Ira, that character, I like her just because she's so different. Yeah. She comes from a place that's so different from everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, she gets kind of drafted into the military. And like, what can you do? And she's like, not a whole lot. And like, I remember they came down and like, can you read and write? And she's like, my name. I'm like, okay, we got a lot of work to do. But.
Yeah.
So
got our hands full with this one.
Yeah. So I like those three characters. Those were fun.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I like about Ira, is I don't like what Dragon Naturally Speaking tries to do every time I say Ira. Okay, you know. She is an absolutely fundamental part of the DNA of the House of Murphy down the road. And until you see her in action, you don't really realize how downright brilliant this uneducated, ignorant barbarian is. Okay? Because she is. And you still tend to underrate her a lot in places as you're going along, because she's like her life had zero structure, zero control in it, until she was simply trying to exist with her brother under almost impossible circumstances, and then she loses her brother. Okay, so for her, SOP structure, okay, this is the greatest thing that anybody ever gave her, with structure and purpose and a sense that she knows who she is and where she is and that she has control by fitting into that structure, control of herself, that she knows who she is and where she is, and she has people who matter to her, and she matters to other people. Okay, this is just an incredible gift to her. And Callum, for example, doesn't really grasp just how critical a gift that is to her until she actually explains it to him in this book. But this is an absolutely brilliant young woman, okay, and a very lethal one, okay. And if you've been keeping an eye on her, you've known this all along. But I think it begins to become more obvious with the final scene with Admiral Z in Governor, and then in the course of this book. I really like her a lot. I really do. Now, I think, obviously, Murphy is one of the characters who I really like writing, because he's so pivotal, and because, in a sense, all of this is happening because of him, because of the sense of responsibility and the personal honor that's kind of baked into him from the get-go. I like writing Sydney, his wife, especially the scenes with her father, as he's being kind of dragged, kicking and screaming to the side of the light. Okay, and one of the things that I think is really good about him and her is the sense that the awareness that the corruption that produced the 500 is so damn seductive and insidious that you don't realize you're corrupt until you're brought face to face with the consequences of the system that you're part of. And then you have to decide where you stand and what you're going to do about it. And that's our window into that side of the 500. In many ways. Now, I liked writing Regenda. I'm not that fond of Regenda at this point, but I kind of liked writing him. Especially the scene where he and Murphy are discussing his less than stellar performance when he comes out to sort Murphy out.
If you ever had that one in-law you can't stand.
Yeah, it's like, I hated you from the day I met you. But I had a lot of fun, or not fun, but I writing the scene where Murphy is explaining to Callum why Regenda doesn't like him and why he doesn't like Regenda. And when Regenda hits Murphy between the teeth you've just destroyed your entire family. Okay. And the hell of it is that from the perspective of the 500 in the existing system, that's exactly what Murphy has just done. And yet he has no choice but to do it. Okay. that's one of the themes that I, one of the aspects of the story I wanted to deal with, was the cost to the people that he loves of doing what he knows he needs to do. And there's the scene where he explains to Callum that, you know, I knew your uncle was right. I should never have married your mother. And Callum is like, how can you say that? And he's like, because I knew that I was headed someplace like this all along. And what right did I have to drag her along, drag you along with me? It was just that I loved her so damn much. Okay. I mean, Matt, to me, is the heart of Terrence Murphy and Simi, his wife. And it's, like I say, you know, it's cuts to the crux of, you know, how much are you willing to pay for to do what you know is the right thing? Okay. And Murphy's not doing it because he's sanctimonious. He's not doing it for, you know, any of that stuff. He's doing it because he literally doesn't have a choice, because he knows what's happening, or at least a part of what's happening.
Well, and I really like Murphy because one, he's a part of the establishment. You know, he's of the 500, and
yeah,
his life would be so much easier if he just rode along and you know did what they told him to do. He'd have a pretty good life.
Yeah.
But he is compelled to take the hard road. You know,
but it's kind of like, it's kind of like somebody gave Cassandra a Vorpal blade. Okay. I mean, you know, nobody listened to her. They went out and got the damn horse, you know, the whole nine yards. She said, don't do it, you know, kind of thing. Well, Murphy's Cassandra, because he sees where this is. He doesn't see the fullness of where it's headed because he doesn't really know everything the Rish are up to. Okay. But he sees the shipwreck coming, and he sees the damage that's being done to human beings in the fringe, you know, every day. They don't care, you know, the 500 didn't care who gets ground up in the system, you know, et cetera. He sees that. But unlike Cassandra, he can grab them by the front of their shirt, slap them four or five times, and say, now you're going to have to listen to me. Okay. Except that it turns out that listening to him isn't enough because they refuse to pay attention. And so it's kind of, John W. Campbell, many, many years ago, said, history repeats herself and repeats herself until finally she lashes out with a club and says, now will you learn? Okay. Terrence Murphy is the club for the 500. Okay. And that's really what he was structured, what he was created to be, in this storyline, from the get-go. But one of the reasons that the Terran Empire is still as strong as it is by the time that Alicia DeVries comes along, you know, 300-400 years later, is because of what gets built into its DNA when it's created. The fact that the last thing that Murphy wants to do is be an emperor. Okay, even at the end of Rebel, that's the last thing he wants to do. And there are actually a couple of scenes in here where his XO and his son are both kind of looking at him and going, you know, Terry, there's only so long you're going to be able to dodge around and avoid the inevitable here. You know, and I think O'Hanrahan sees that. Not O'Hanrahan. O'Hanrahan is the journalist from the Universe.
Hanrahan.
Hanrahan, yes. See, O'Hanrahan, Hanrahan. I think of him as Harry, usually. You know, kind of thing. But he sees more clearly, I think, in many respects than Murphy does, because it's so important to Murphy that he is not doing any of this for personal power or personal gain. Okay, that's the last thing that he wants out of any of this. And Hanrahan understands that. but he also understands that there's a streak of the romantic in Murphy that needs to believe that the system can be fixed. Literally needs to believe that. And at the end of Rebel, he's forced to concede that it can't be fixed. So it's the title of the book is really, you know, the first one was Governor, this one's Rebel. The next one was going to be Imperator, and may still be. I don't know. We'll have to think about that. But where it's going to be a case of the Murphy hoping for the Roman office of dictator, as in someone appointed by the Senate to have absolute power for a limited period of time to deal with an emergency. That's what he's going to hope he's dealing with here. And Hanratty's going to be going, yeah, sure, you believe that, Terry. You go right ahead. You believe that. You know, it ain't going to work out that way, but you go right ahead, you know. And, you know, we're really, everybody around him is going to recognize what has to happen before he's willing to accept what has to happen. And so there's this little corner, this incredibly clear-sighted, insightful person where he needs to, in effect, lie to himself. Because otherwise, he would be like, am I really doing this because I need to, or am I doing it because I just crave power and the exercise of power because I do it well? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And when I say he needs to lie to, he literally needs to lie to himself about it because he never could have started on this voyage if there'd been any question in his mind, any suspicion in his mind, that he might wind up an emperor at the end of it. He literally couldn't have done it. I'm hoping that that's clear to the readers as we go along. Because it's an absolutely central part of who he is and why he's doing this. And it's also an absolutely central part about why the people doing it with him are willing to do it with him.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
She'd shifted the locations 3 times, including rotating the gate half a turn, as she considered factors from height clearance, use of the overhead crane during construction, the ease of getting large materials into place, and finally the local ley lines, faint as they might be. Riki appeared with the materials list and a surprising array of office chairs just as she was spray-painting the final location onto the workshop floor. He also had a lunch of steamed fish, brown rice, and more pickles. She took the list and studied it as she ate. Again, she found the Oni depressingly efficient, though non-creative. They had slavishly gathered what had been used to build the orbital gate and nothing else. We need something for the superstructure of the gate, something inert and non-metallic. If we were on Elfhome, I'd use ironwood. I don't suppose you have something similar?
Ironwood?
Yeah?
You want to use ironwood?
She flicked her pickles at him. Hello, that's what I said. I know you understand English, Mr. Born and Raised in Berkeley. It's just using wood as so low tech. To quote you, doh, from little mines come no solutions. Ironwood is stunningly strong, renewable, non-toxic, recyclable, and easy to work with. Do the Oni have anything like it or not? We can get ironwood. She waited for explanations, but they weren't forthcoming. I'm talking massive timbers. She held out her hands to show the beam size. Riki nodded. Just tell me how much and I'll get it. Okay. We're in business then. Time blurred for the rest of the day as she designed the wood framework. Riki came and went, searching out samples of the ceramic tiles and other materials stockpiled elsewhere. Each item fired new ideas, and she branched out to how to affix the tiles, a ramp over the threshold to protect the gate, and a preliminary sketch of the power supply grid. Night fell, and shadows in the warehouse grew deeper. Chiyo brought dinner, and almost instantly the female and Riki started bickering in Oni. Tinker sighed, leaning back in her chair to look up through the skylight. She expected the stars to be strange and unfamiliar, like the sky of Earth. First Wolf, though, was right overhead, his shoulder star the brightest thing in the sky as always. It was comforting to see it, so very familiar. Then it struck her. It was too familiar. She leaned from side to side to see more through the overhead rectangle of plexiglass, studying the constellations, the moon spinners, the dark-eyed widow. It was the sky of Elf Home overhead. And suddenly it was all clear to her. You have a prisoner, extremely intelligent, to whom you need to give great freedom and entrust with a great deal of material that could easily be twisted into weapons. Wouldn't the simplest method of holding said prisoner be simply to convince her that she is in another dimension? Even if she fled the building, the whole world would act as a prison. Escape would seem impossible. She had to still be on Elf Home. Why else would they paint the warehouse windows to keep her from seeing outside? How else could Riki be on Elf Home prior to shutdown and after startup, and yet have a copy of her computer system up and running? How had he access to office chairs and ironwood? How he got her to the castle? If Riki could pop back and forth freely between Elf Home and Onihida, carrying kidnapped girls, ergonomic workstations, and large trees, the Oni had no need of a gate. And yet, she couldn't completely explain away the city outside the windows. How had they tricked her so completely? Kitsune are the fox spirits, Lane had told her. They usually appear to be beautiful women, but they really are just foxes that can throw illusions into their victim's mind. Was the spider she felt every morning Chiyo stepping into her mind, reading it and planting illusions? When she considered it, she could find a dozen times Chiyo had reacted to her thoughts. Chiyo could read her mind. Tinker glanced over at Chiyo, who was still arguing with Riki. Her greatest weapon was her enemy's ignorance. As long as they didn't realize she had discovered the truth, they would continue to allow her the freedom of the workshop. And with the workshop, she could build tools to escape. But Chiyo mustn't discover that she knew. The fight finished up when an Oni guard came into the warehouse to fetch Riki away, leaving behind Chiyo to guard Tinker. To distract herself, Tinker started to factor out large numbers, looking for primes. Chiyo winced at her. What are you doing? Factoring numbers? Tinker said truthfully. Chiyo rubbed her forehead. You're a hideously ugly little creation. Tinker gathered together all the cordless screwdrivers and started to remove the battery packs. The joy of being a genius was that you could do complex math in your head while assembling simple but effective weapons, almost thoughtlessly. Trying not to grin, Tinker switched to determining escape velocities, which reduced Chiyo to quiet whimpers of pain.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz, and good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week in the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.